So, Gil, we lost three greats.
Yes.
In the last couple of weeks.
And, yeah.
And
Joe Bologna.
Wonderful Joe Bologna from a movie, my favorite year, that we talk about all the time.
And I remember Joe Bologna popping up for one of those really scary, pilots that they would hide in Married with Children.
Oh, that's right.
And it was Joe Bologna and Matt LeBlanc
was his son. Yes, yeah, I have a memory of that.
Where, like, the Bundys would say, hey, you know, our good friend so-and-so is here. And we go, well, if they're such good friends, how come they've never once mentioned
I remember
him?
That pilot. But there, he was a versatile guy who did a lot of things.
Oh,
and
yes.
Very, very funny in the Sid Caesar part in My Favorite Year.
Yeah, and he was also in another one of his favorite Naked movies.
Blame It on Rio. Stanley Donen.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, Joe was on our short list. People laugh at us and they say, you know, why don't you get this person? Why don't you get that person? We don't know these people intimately enough to know who's not doing well.
Yes.
And who's sick. Obviously, we would put them at the top of the list. We did not know Joe was ailing. He was on my list and on our list, and we would have loved to have him. Just a funny guy and a real versatile talent. Good in dramas, too. Good in everything.
Oh, yeah.
And we also lost the great Dick Gregory, who you were just speaking about.
Dick Gregory, I met at the Hugh Hefner roast where I did the Aristocrats. And Dick Gregory came over and was complimenting me, shaking my hand. And he said, and I want to thank you for your beautiful mind.
Isn't that great?
That was wonderful.
What a wonderful compliment.
Yeah. It was just a great
compliment. And what a groundbreaker he was.
Yeah.
You know, we were just talking about him.
How Hugh Hefner, he praised Hugh Hefner. Everyone else was roasting, but he had nothing but praise.
Because he was instrumental in helping him out very early in his career, and he worked on behalf of civil rights. And he was an interesting guy, Gregory, who wasn't just a performer. He had a very interesting life.
And
became an activist, ran for president.
Yeah, then he went on to be this health food advocate.
That's right. If you remember, he intervened in the situation with Walter Hudson, who was that obese man that they had to they had to take down the walls of his house, and Dick Gregory put him on a diet and on his health program, and he did a lot of good things for a lot of people for a long time, and a legendary comic. If you guys don't know a lot about him, dig into the archives, and of course. We'll talk more about these people, by the way, on the end of the year in memoriam show.
Yeah.
This is just a short mention. We'll go into more detail. But, of course, last but not least, we have
the
to
legendary Jerry Lewis.
Yeah. And that was expected, not unexpected, but still shocking.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, he was 91, and he had every ailment in the past few years. It looked like nothing would stop him.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, he's just, and I sent out a tweet and I meant it. The French were right all along.
That was a great tweet. Yeah. And you knew him. You got to know him.
One time I was at an event and I got up and spoke, you know, dirty and bad taste and all my usual.
Shocking.
And Lewis came over to me with that stern look on his face that scared you.
Yes.
And he said, Gilbert, you are out of your fucking mind. And then he takes a pause and goes, and I wouldn't want you any other way.
Great. I wish you had that.
What a compliment.
Some impressive compliments from Jerry Lewis and Dick Gregory.
Yeah.
You've had some in your life. And he was a comedy influence on you as a kid.
Oh,
he's
absolutely.
Come up a million times on the show. We talked about him with Rupert Holmes. We talked about him with Mark Hudson and lots of people.
I still remember being a little kid sitting with my parents watching The Nutty Professor in a theater and sitting with my grandmother watching The Family Jewels.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was more than an influence. He was kind of a comedy hero.
Oh, yeah.
For you as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. Lewis. And there was no way that, see, that's something else. Like, I don't know the stories behind it, but muscular dystrophy just dumped Jerry Lewis.
Yeah.
And I thought it was just so wrong because You didn't watch the Muscular Dystrophy Telethon. You watched the Jerry Lewis telethon.
Absolutely.
That was it.
Absolutely.
And no matter where you were, you had to be home to see him sing Walk On.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's showbiz history that will never come again.
Oh no.
It belongs to another era, as did he, but you know, and people talk about him as a filmmaker and all the other achievements and innovations, and he taught film school.
Oh,
I mean, he did a lot of other things, and we've talked about the King of Comedy. We have limited time here, but we have Drew Friedman coming on in a couple of weeks, and he knew Jerry too, and we'll talk to Drew more about Jerry, and we'll do a whole Jerry show down the line. But big loss.
Oh, absolutely.
So
there were a number of articles about the France mystery, or it's a bit of a mystery, I think, you know, that
they
revered him
about that was, you know, in America, we always made fun of, oh, like the French, they look at this idiot Jerry Lewis as a genius and the next Chaplin. And who is Jerry Lewis making a movie that takes place in a concentration camp? And then Roberto Benigni comes
here. Yes, that's right. Gets nominated for an Oscar.
Yes. 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 And we want to give him every Oscar there is. We're calling him the next Chaplin. We're calling him a genius. And we're honoring Life is Beautiful.
I know. I guess it depends on the context. Anyway, Jerry Lewis is a big topic that we can't really cover here in 10 minutes, and nor is Dick, and same with Dick Gregory. But we'll do an in memoriam at the end of the year. We'll cover this in detail, and we'll try to do a separate Jerry episode. Maybe we'll even put a little panel together of people that knew Jerry and worked with him, like Rupert and Drew, and some of the other people.
So many superlative comments about Jerry when he died.
Yeah.
I loved Seinfeld's comment, which was, you know, if you don't like Jerry Lewis, you know, Jerry Lewis is the essence of comedy, was his thing.
And Jim Carrey said there would be no me if there wasn't him.
Oh, yeah. That's so great.
We'll do something about it down the line. But anyway, we wanted to mark those passings.
Yeah.
Three giants.
This is Gilbert Gottfried, and this is Gilbert Gottfried's amazing, colossal podcast with my co-host, Frank Santopadre. We're once again recording at Nutmeg with our engineer, Frank Verderosa. Our guest this week is a musician, songwriter, and record producer, and one of the most popular and versatile and successful recording artists of his generation. As both a solo artist and the lead singer of the 60s group Tommy James and the Shondells, he recorded 14 top 40 hits, including the top 10 singles I Think We're Alone Now, Crystal Blue Persuasion, Sweet Cherry Wine, Dragon the Line, the rock anthem Moni Moni, and the number one hits Hanky Panky and Crimson and Clover. In a career spanning 7 decades, he's played to sold-out arenas, had his songs covered by everyone from Prince to R.E.M. to Bruce Springsteen. And he's recorded 23 gold singles, 9 gold and platinum albums, and sold over 100 million records worldwide. His fascinating and at times frightening memoir is called Me, the Mob, and the Music. And trust me, once you start reading it, you won't be able to put it down. Please welcome to the podcast a show business survivor and a genuine rock and roll icon, Tommy James.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
Wow.
Well, now I'm going to go take a nap. Yes.
I don't know what to say. I'm impressed.
Yes.
Welcome, Tommy. And Jonathan Nash is also here with Tommy.
That's right.
A gifted songwriter and a singer and
chandelier.
Jazz guitarist. What do you call him?
Chandelier.
Oh, he's a chandelier.
Right.
Which is an offshoot. He's not an original chandelle.
Well,
but
it's an appendage.
Oh,
I'm a practicing chandelist.
Not a Shonda.
And he's a chandelier guy. Yeah.
I am so proud to do the show. I want to tell you, I'm a huge, huge fan.
Oh, thank you.
And I just, I've listened to you before, and I thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
What a kick. It's nice great thing to hear, huh?
And to show what a wild career you've had, no less than Martin Scorsese wanted to do a movie.
Well, you know,
you.
We have been really lucky with the book, which you're talking about, Me, the Mob, and the Music, which came out several years ago. And as soon as we released the book, it was released through Simon & Schuster, we started getting calls for the movie rights and for the Broadway rights. And actually, Barbara DeFina is producing the movie, and Matthew Stone just did the screenplay, and a director is being obtained right now as we speak, and things are moving along at a really nice clip, and I am so, you know, I've never done anything like this before. I've never done a film before, and I'm a real novice in this. And I am getting one hell of an education.
Oh, yes.
And it's really amazing because everyone who comes on the team is a separate negotiation. And, you know, everybody's got a schedule and an ego and everything. So we are really moving forward with this. And I'm just as happy as I can be.
And your first song, this is very weird. You stole from a group who they themselves stole from another
yes
group.
Equal opportunity.
We're talking about Hanky Panky?
Yeah. Hanky Panky. Well, this, is, of course, is back in high school.
Yeah.
I saw some friends of mine called the Rivieras made it with a record called California.
Oh, sure.
And I was
love
so jealous I couldn't stand it. I'm from a little town in Michigan called Niles, Michigan. And I worked in a record shop all through high school, and I had my band all through school. And so I was so jealous I couldn't stand myself. And finally, we had two little label deals when I was in high school, one in junior high, one in senior. And the latter one was a little label called Snap Records, and it was run by a guy named Jack Douglas, who was a DJ at WNIL Radio Studios in Niles. And so he came in and asked me if I would want to record for his label, my band and I. And we said, yes! And so there was...
In your best Gilbert Gottfried
yes,
imitation.
Yes, I did, actually. So, one of the four sides was Hanky Panky, which ended up being our first hit. And I had actually seen another group play it and saw what it did to people, putting people on the dance floor, which is really what it was all about.
Now, yeah. When it first came out, it was just like a moderate.
A local... Dud, really?
Yeah,
like three states.
Yeah. Well, you know, it went number one in about four blocks.
Okay,
and but we had no distribution, so the record died. This is in 1964. It was released. I was a junior, and so the record kind of came and went. And the following year, I graduated in '65, and I took my band on the road. We played Chicago up through Wisconsin and Illinois, and. We had forgotten about the record. So in early 1966, I'm playing this dumpy little club in Janesville, Wisconsin. Yeah. And right in the middle of my 2 weeks, the IRS shuts the guy down for not paying his and we get sent home. So we went home feeling like real dogs, you know, real losers. And as soon as I got home, that's how the good Lord works. Because as soon as I got home, I got the call that changed my life, that Hanky Panky, this record that I had recorded 2 years before that, was sitting at, they had bootlegged it and sold 80,000 copies in 10 days and was sitting at number one in the city of Pittsburgh. And of course, Pittsburgh was a major market, so that was a big deal. And I said, who is this? They finally convinced me they were for real. And I went to Pittsburgh and I couldn't put the original band back together. So I went there by myself and the record producer, Jack Douglas. And sure enough, we're number one outside the city limits. I'm nobody. As soon as we, you know, go into How the weird. Tunnel and come out the other side, I'm a rock star. And so I basically picked a group from Pittsburgh to be the new Shondells. And we went to New York a week later, and that was how it started.
A Jeff Barry song.
Well, yeah, there's lots more, but
Ellie Greenwich.
I'll stop
Barry.
And take a breath there. Yeah.
And you had, like, all these major record labels wanting you.
When we got to New York, it was fascinating. Actually, I had never been to New York before. I'm like a frog in a hailstorm, you know. And all of the labels said yes. We couldn't believe it. CBS, RCA, Atlantic, all the major labels. And labels like Kamasutra. Remember Kamasutra?
Sure.
And finally, the last place we took the record to was Roulette Records. Now, Roulette was a fairly large indie label, and it was they'd had a lot of hits. And so we left a record, and it was, but I went to bed feeling real good that night, feeling like we were going to sign with one of the majors. And about 9 o'clock the next morning, we started getting calls from all the people who had said yes the day before, now said, listen, Tom, we got to pass. I said, what? And I said, finally, Jerry Wexler at Atlantic told us the truth, that Morris Levy, the head of Roulette Records, had called all the other labels and scared them off. He says, this is my record. Back off.
So so tell us a little about Morris Levy.
Sure. Well, of course, the thing that made it interesting is that Morris Levy was right out of the movies.
I mean, he talked like this.
He was about 300 pounds. He was about 6'4" and a half or 5", and just a really big, intimidating guy. And of course, what we didn't know. When, it was the first offer I couldn't refuse. what we didn't know at the time when we signed was that Roulette Records, in addition to being a functioning indie label and a pretty good one, was also a front for the Genovese crime family in New York, which we didn't know anything about. We found out later. And so meeting Morris Levy was really interesting. And that was where we ended up. So,
you're a kid. You're 19 years old.
Yeah.
When all this is happening.
Right. First trip to New York.
Amazing.
It must be pretty flattering that Morris Levy was literally willing to kill for you to sign with.
The godfather of the music.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. We, of course, didn't know who we were rubbing shoulders with. And, these guys would use... Roulette as a social club, basically. And, we'd meet somebody in Morris's office, and a week later, I'd see him on TV being taken out of a warehouse in New Jersey, in handcuffs doing the perp walk. And isn't that the guy we just met at Morris's office? And it would be,
And Morris Levy and all the guys that worked for him, you said in the book.
Yeah.
Always had a baseball bat in arm's length.
Yeah, that's a story.
Yeah. Well, it's the truth.
Were they ball players? Sure.
Play a great game of softball. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, what happened was I'll never forget at the signing. Two big tough guys come walking into the Morris's office and say, "Mice, can we see you a minute?" And he goes, "Excuse me." Everybody talked like this.
Yeah.
They went to school. So, he went over and we could hear the conversation and we'd hear things like,
"You had to break the guy's legs."
And I'm thinking, whoa. And
bootlegging the record.
And I'd turn over like this to Red Schwartz, who was the promo man. And he'd say, "Well, Tom, first trip to New York."
I'm trying to make small talk.
And so anyway, that's how it went. And what I'm saying, but what's so amazing was they took the record to number one. They actually did. They actually did a great job of promoting the record. We had one hit after another, and they made it number one all over the world. And you know, the funny part about all this is that if we'd have gone with one of the corporate labels,
hey, you said you would have been a one-hit wonder.
Exactly. Yeah. We'd have been lucky to be a one-hit wonder. You know, we'd have been handed over to some in-house A&R guy, and that's probably the last time anybody would have heard from
us. So this was bad news, good news.
Yes.
And, signing with Morris.
And that, the whole story was good, bad, love, hate.
Well, they were in the singles business. They knew how to make hit records.
They knew how to make
hits. And Morris was called him the godfather of the music business.
Yeah, he had a lot of stuff going on. Of course, we were walking on eggshells up there because there was so much hanky-panky going on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And you told one story in the book where Morris found out that there was some guy bootlegging.
Oh, I love that one.
Yeah, well, yeah. That was at the signing. We found out that... Morris found out somebody was bootlegging one of his records, and he would turn to his secretary Karen and say,
"Where's my baseball bat? Call my lawyer."
As he was leaving, you knew something was about to happen. But that's the kind of stuff that would go on at Roulette, and I honestly, there was this. I constantly had these mixed feelings because, once we realized that mechanical royalties were not going to happen, we had to make a decision. Do we stay here, take our life in our hands and try to leave? Because, Jimmie Rogers earlier had a real
tell us about Jimmie Rogers.
Oh, wait, but just to complete that other story.
Oh, I know which one you want. The guy in the warehouse.
Yeah. He was printing it and,
So, Morris wouldn't hesitate to, taking some of his goons in there. And of course, then he'd do something nice. He would remember the guy. Yeah, is that the story about
the guy's kid
started smashing.
Yeah.
First they went in and smashed this guy's machine.
Yes. Then they douse him with gasoline, too, and Morris lit a match?
Well. yes, I mean, that was, but I mean, but before he did all that, he didn't follow through with that.
Right.
But the guy had a sick kid or something, and Morris put the kid in the hospital.
The guy started
paid for his
crying and pleading that I'm doing it because my son needs an operation.
Right.
And then
Morris ended up paying for the operation.
You said in the book that Morris went with this guy to the hospital to make sure, or he'd kill him if he was lying.
Well, the thing of it is, I always, Morris was probably the most fascinating character I ever met in my life because he was such a dichotomy. He was so schizophrenic. I don't mean he was nuts. I mean that he was unpredictable. And in many ways, he had some very noble qualities, but he always had this dark side. And I used to watch him do business, and I'd be fascinated watching him operate. He knew everybody. I mean, the next person that came in the office could be Cardinal Spellman.
Right.
Yeah, because you had said that he came in with his henchmen, smashed all this guy's machines, doused the records with gasoline, and then when they went to the hospital, this guy's son was in the hospital, and Morris Levy called the doctor over and said, "How much is this operation going to cost?" And he took out his checkbook.
Yeah.
And he signed it and handed it to the doctor.
Yes,
and
isn't that an incredible story?
It's wild. I saw in a movie, I wouldn't believe it.
I know.
Well, that's why the book would make such a great movie.
Well, something? I feel like I had this like I say, it was you know, like an abusive father-son relationship. And the slaps the kid around, but he sends him to college, mm-hmm. it was that kind of a relationship. And I, when Morris passed away, I really missed the guy, in so many ways. It's strange to say, but I mean, that is I'm left with after.
You were on the road when he passed away? You didn't really have closure.
I was. And in the movie and in the book, we have this sort of imaginary conversation at the very end. In fact, we did this very new version of I Think We're Alone Now, slow, acoustic, very pretty. And it's amazing how the lyrics held up in this middle of this very solemn moment when Morris died. And it's going to be the closing credits of the movie is this version of I Think We're Alone Now. But I was literally very shocked. I didn't know that it was that close, that he was that close to dying. And I was going to go up and see him the following day when I got back to New York. And I never got a chance to say what I wanted to say to him.
And it's so strange because it's kind of like how men and women will talk about a relationship, and they'll say, well, it's complicated.
Yes.
It was complicated.
And it was like, because Morris Levy, he cheated you. Like highway robbery. It's like $40 million or something like.
But on the other hand, every time I go to say something nasty about Morris and Roulette, if it wasn't for Morris, there wouldn't be a Tommy James. And I, seriously, and I'm very aware of that fact. So I have to almost look at this philosophically and almost spiritually. I have to look at it because, the guy, he was convicted. He went through a lot of bad stuff, but he made me happen, made the group happen, and did so many things. I mean, he got me out of going to Vietnam. I would have been on my way.
That's an interesting story in the book. Suddenly you're 4F.
Yes.
Yeah. Not sure why.
That's right. That's right. Neither was anybody else.
Calls were made.
Just real quick, Morris was, let me set this up a little bit. I was 3A. I was married and had a child. And this is the week I did my first Ed Sullivan show, February of 69. And I had gotten my draft physical notice in the mail and told that 3A was no longer a deferment. Everybody was 1A. So we were going. That's when they were taking, blind nuns to be. Yeah. If you had a heartbeat, you were going to Vietnam. So Morris, as it was friends, was on the board of directors of the Chemical Bank.
Wow.
You talk about the fox guarding the hen house, right? And one of his best friends, who was also on the board, was the head of the Selective Service in New York. And I'm not going to mention any.
Oh, no.
So all I know is that when I took my physical, and at the end of the day, this very nasty looking sergeant that gives you your draft card and your classification says to me, I don't know who you know, but, and he throws down the card and it's 4F, and nobody was getting a 4F. They were getting a 1Y, which means come back in a year. So I didn't argue with him.
No.
I just, left. But that was just so amazing. And
the double-edged sword, again, that was Morris Levy.
And he was a powerful guy.
Yeah.
And in typical mob fashion, you say in the book, like, any favor you'd ask of him, he would do for you. With the exception of paying you your money.
Right. Right.
Isn't that funny, though? How, he'd
John's laughing.
He was worth... Yeah. tens of millions of dollars, but he would have still rather stolen $5,000 from you.
Yes,
you know, he would choose the dark side.
Yeah, well, you have a line in the book that he would rather do a deal dishonestly.
Yes,
for a dollar,
took pleasure
than a $10 million deal. Yes. Legitimately.
And he could have been a CEO of any major corporation. This guy was brilliant. He could hear hits. He could leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Yeah.
But you know, he was just amazing. And so I would watch this, and that's part of what made him so fascinating.
But in typical mob fashion, he would do you a favor, mm-hmm. but he would remember it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You had to do anything he asked you to do after
I mean, there was basically, you know, not getting nuts about not getting royalties. Now, don't get me wrong, we weren't paupers. I mean, we're getting, we had our monies from touring and from BMI, from the radio airplay, from commercials and all the other things we were doing. But, you know, mechanical royalties were just not going to happen. And I think a lot of favors that boiled down to a lot of favors as far as he was concerned for me not, you know, going after my royalties.
Yeah.
Don't go away. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hi, this is Bill Macy, and you're listening to Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Podcast.
Amazing Colossal Podcast.
I'll do it again.
Okay.
Hi, this is Bill Macy. You're listening to Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Podcast. Colossal.
Yeah,
but you keep leaving out colossal. But
you know, you can improvise it, Bill, and say anything you want.
Isn't this Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with Bill Macy?
Yes.
That's what I just said.
And then there's more. That uncompromising, enterprising, anything but tranquilizing. Right on, boom, boom.
It's Gilbert and Frank's Amazing Colossal Podcast.
Hey, Gil.
Yeah.
Why don't we, as long as we have the guitars here and we want to squeeze a couple of songs in, why don't we...
Are we getting paid for this?
No. Gilbert's the new Morris Levy.
I mean, I'm still singing for my supper here.
Now, can we do Moni Moni?
Well, you want to do that one first?
Yeah.
Why don't we
want to sing Dragon the Line with me, or I Think We're Alone?
Dragon the Line.
He doesn't have the lyrics. He doesn't have the lyrics for Dragon the Line.
How about I Think We're Alone?
Okay.
Well, do you want to do your song first?
No.
Well, why don't we do I Think You're Alone? I Think We're Alone now, and Gilbert will join in.
Okay.
And then you guys can do two that are unmolested.
I see. Well, let's see.
We're going to indulge Gilbert. What do you think, Gil?
Yes.
Children behave.
There you go.
That's what they say when we're together. And watch how you play.
No publishing on this.
They don't understand. And so we're running just as fast as we can.
Stay with them, Gil.
Holding on to one another's hand. Trying to get away into the arms around me and we tumble to the ground. And then you say, I think we're alone now. There doesn't seem to be anyone around. I think we're alone now. The beating of our hearts is the only sound. Look at the
way. Wait a minute. Oh, wow.
Look at the wave. We gotta hide what we're doing.
Oh, yeah.
Cause what would they say if they only knew? And so we're running just as fast as we can, holding on to one another's hand, trying to get away into the night. And then you put your arms around me as we tumble to the ground. And then you say, I think we're alone now. Uh-huh. There doesn't seem to be anyone around. I think we're alone now. The beating of our hearts is the only sound.
Just hold your horses.
Okay.
I think we're alone now.
There doesn't seem to be anyone around. I think we're alone now. The beating of our hearts is the only sound. I think we're alone now. There doesn't seem to be anyone around.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Oh.
Eat your heart out, Tiffany.
This is very spontaneous. You do know that.
Wow, we appreciate the way you carried him there, Tom.
Well, thank you.
I thought I was
carrying
you. Want to
get a tambourine? You got a gig.
Another person that fascinated me, because the way he came about in the business, and it's like a who's who of the mob world and murders. And that's Tommy Boley. And so what was, there was a whole history of one guy shooting the other and the other guy stabbing that one. And
Tommy came to a bad end, huh?
Well, I'll tell you. The best way I can explain it is Tommy Eboli was one of Morris's main partners up there. And he was a big guy in the Genovese family. Now, this is before February of 69. And he was up there a lot. And so what happened was Valentine's Day of 1969, Vito Genovese died in prison. And Tommy Eboli became the don or the boss of the family. And this really made Morris's position interesting because, you know, Morris was his partner in Roulette Records. So what happened was that a mob war broke out. Eboli was a very influential guy, and also over there was Vinnie Gigante.
Oh, Vinnie the Chin.
Yeah. Who walked around in the bathrobe. And
right, sure.
Remember,
he was recently trying to prove his insanity by walking around New York in a
he
bathrobe?
He walked around Little Italy in his beat-up bathrobe.
That's the guy.
That, like, so he was crazy.
He was also there quite often. And so this was a, you know, but Tommy Eboli was the boss of the family. And he was killed, actually, in 1972 in June. We were playing the Brooklyn Paramount Theater that night. It was a Saturday night. And about six blocks away, he was assassinated. He was killed. And, of course, that just, you know, Roulette just went nuts. Everything at Roulette just went nuts the following Monday morning when I got up there. And I wrote about it in the book. But it was It was quite an amazing moment. And that's about the time I started saying, I got to get out of here. This one way or another, this can't end well, and I'm leaving matter what.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, let's introduce John here. Just tell us how you met, how you guys got connected in the first place.
Jonathan Ashe was actually, I met him in 1966,
the Trade Winds.
The Trade Winds in a club in Newburgh, New York, and. He was the bass player in a group called the Coachmen, which just happens to be the old name of my group before
Billy King and the Coachmen.
Yeah, good one. Yeah. So anyway, I met him there, and he was a good friend with Pete Lucia, who became our drummer in '67. And John was always a good friend. I didn't have a place for him in the group, but John would always fill in if there was an illness, or if we needed somebody in the studio. John was on a lot of the hit records. Moni Moni, he played bass.
Yep.
He'd play a guitar on many of them. And John has just been my friend for a very long time, and he's back with the group now. And it's awfully fun to have John to kick around.
See, oh, my story is going to sound really boring now, you see.
No, do it. So tell about Moni Moni.
The Moni Moni story is actually pretty funny. So I actually did get drafted. I was drafted in 1968.
You needed Morris in your corner.
I did need him. Yeah. I needed him bad. But I wound up going in, came home on leave, and Pete Lucia, our mutual friend, he's a childhood friend of mine.
Our drummer.
Yep. Called me, said, listen, Tommy's going to do some demos. Would you like to come in and play bass? I said, sure. What am I doing? So we go in and started. We recorded all through the night. And one of the songs was Do Something to Me, but the other song, we had no idea what it was going to be. It was just no lyrics, no title.
Party rock.
Party rock and roll.
You knew you wanted kind of a nonsense thing, like Boney Maroney?
Well, yes.
Or Hang on Sloopy or something?
Yes, we did.
But you didn't?
We had this, let me just tell them, we had this track with no lyrics. And, you know, it just morphed gradually into what we know as Moni Moni today. But we had no title. It was the night before the recording session. We had the track, and we still had no title. We had lyrics, but we had no title. And we're looking for a Sloopy or some kind of silly, you know, mm-hmm. some two-syllable word. And so Richie Cordell, my songwriting partner, and I walk out on my terrace. I'm at 52nd and 8th in New York. And we look up into the nighttime sky, and the first thing our eyes fall on is the Mutual of New York Insurance Company, MONY. Remember with the dollar sign in the middle of the O and gave you the time and the weather? And we're looking at Moni. Moni! That's it. We don't see your kid. It was like God saying, here's the title. And so that became the title of the song. So John.
So the rest of the story.
Yes.
Is I went back to my base at Fort McClellan, Alabama. And so we recorded in May of 68, and the song came out in August of 68. So here I am outside. Somebody's got a boom box out there, and I hear this familiar music. I'm going, wait a minute. That's me playing on that record.
That's great.
And all the GIs are going, oh, yeah, sure it is, Antonato.
Oh, yeah. Right. You know? Nobody believed
it. So that was the Moni Moni story.
Now, there's one story in the book, because I remember when I was a kid watching the Beatles on Sullivan that night, and you were watching it with your parents.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I remember under John Lennon's picture, it said, sorry, girls, he's married.
Right.
And what did your father say?
Oh, that's funny.
He says, I wonder which one of those queers he's married to.
Okay, Dad. Dad wasn't a big rock fan.
You know, as long as we're talking about Sullivan, tell us about doing the Sullivan show.
Okay, well, the first Sullivan show that I did was, it was terrifying. I don't know how else to say it. The week before, we had just finished a tour in L.A. Of the Canadian. We played across Canada with the Beach Boys, and we're down at the Riot House, you know, the Continental Hyatt House in L.A., and we're watching a couple of the Beach Boys were with us, and our guys were in there. We knew we were going to be on the Sullivan Show, and I tried to pick their brain for, you know, they had done the show a half dozen times, and we're like, oh, so what happens? And so they tried to tell us, you know, Carl tried to tell me what, you know, what it was like that Sunday you do this and Monday you're off and Tuesday you start and your makeup's in your boots by the time you do the show. So I was really kind of panicky. And we wanted to watch Ed Sullivan to introduce next week's guest.
All right, right here. He said, all right, here next week, the youngster will be Tony Jones and the Spandels will be here.
That's great. That's a true story. Damn good impression.
So if I wasn't terrified before, I'm going nuts now, right? So we get to the show. Monday was off, and Tuesday we start doing the rehearsals and getting the shots lined up and everything. And by the way, the Sullivan crew was unbelievable. I mean, they were all 106, but nobody did TV better than these guys did. So, you know, gradually I was asked if I would do Crimson and Clover live. Now, you know that that's a train wreck waiting to happen, you know, especially the fade. There's no way they're going to get the fade right with the tremolo and everything. It's just not going to happen. So I beg him, the producer, Bob Precht, who is Sullivan's son-in-law, could you please let me do a lip sync? And so they talked to him. I said, well, okay, but you got to give us a four track so that we can mess with it so it doesn't sound like the record. Okay. So the studio is two blocks away. I live a block away over here. Let me go to the studio, which I did. And I gave them four tracks of mono. so all they could do was raise or lower the volume. So anyway, you know, the VU meters didn't all match either. I had it so there was more bass on one track than the other. So anyway, I gave it to them. They never knew the difference when we did it. But the one thing I forgot to talk about was talking to Ed after the show. If you're the headliner, you got to talk to Ed. And it completely slipped my mind. So after, you know, we get through then the first song I got to do, right, we were scheduled to do Moni Moni and then Crimson and Clover. Well, just before me on the show is Moms Mabley doing Abraham Martin.
Oh, incredible.
Anybody here? And I'm, oh, my God. The cameramen are crying. The audience is bawling. The rest of the crew back there, they're all crying. Everybody's just... And I got to go, okay, let's put your hands together. Hey, here we go. And I got to do Moni Moni after Moms Mabley. And watching Sullivan Boogaloo was a trip.
Wasn't John Biner on one of those shows?
He was.
We had John here.
Yes.
We had him on the podcast.
So anyway, after the show, after I'm done with Crimson and Clover, Ed said, oh, come on over here. Now, Tommy, my boy, I understand you were born and raised in New York City.
No,
I wasn't. So I explained, you know, I was born in Dayton, Ohio. I was raised in Niles, Michigan. I went to school here. We did that. And he said, well, that's wonderful. Once again, born and raised in New York City. Tony Jones. That's true. So,
and the Spandels.
So anyway, that was my first Ed Sullivan show.
And the Sullivan Show was kind of...
What do you want to do now?
Well, I was going to say, the Sullivan Show was a turning point for you in a number of ways, because when you were a kid, you saw Elvis on there, and that
well,
was a...
Well, yes.
That was a
circle had been made.
Yeah. Did you pinch yourself at some point
well,
and say,
yeah.
how
I mean,
the hell did I get
Sullivan
here?
Doing the Sullivan Show back then was just the most amazing feeling. It was like, you know, being at Yankee Stadium. It was, I mean, there was...
Yeah, I was a kid.
Disneyland,
I saw Elvis
everything.
Here.
Yeah.
I saw the Beatles here, and now I'm here. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was... you know, nothing could be that exciting. It was like falling in love for the first time, like hearing your voice on the radio for the first time, you know, all that stuff.
And there was another story in the book that you were booked on a show with the legendary drummer Gene Krupa.
Right, right.
And so tell us what that was like.
Well, that was pretty sad. It was the first time I had ever done Atlantic City and, Steel Pier. And this goes back to the spring of 67. And I remember I was doing it with Ricky Nelson, and I both of our names were in 40-foot letters. You know, he was doing the theater, and I was doing the teen thing at the big Geo Dome, they call it. And in fact, I followed the diving horse. That's how I always knew when I was going to go
on. The diving horse and Mom's Maid.
Yeah, right, right. So anyway, I go back and I look up on stage, and just before us is playing this small big band. You know, it was like three horns, three saxes, three trumpets. It was a small version of a big band. And they sounded really good. And this drummer was sort of older. I didn't recognize anybody. And we go back to the dressing rooms, and I always make it a point to say hello to whoever the opening act is. And so I went and I looked, and there he was. And I was amazed. He was on two folding chairs, passed out in his stage clothes. And the stage manager told me that I looked over. I couldn't believe it. It was Gene Krupa. And, I just felt terrible. And the stage manager told me that, this is what they do in between shows. They just wake him up for the next show. He was apparently a heroin addict. And I just felt awful because he was a big hero of mine. And he died later that year. But that was a story I relayed in the book. Yeah.
And a cautionary tale in a way, because you wound up having your own.
Oh, yes.
Demons.
Then I went and took another pill. And, I the whole thing had great significance for me because, I had my own problems.
Right.
Now, and tell us how you first found out about what they were calling diet pills.
Well, I was my wife's father worked in the post office in Miami. And would send samples from pharmaceutical companies up to, vitamin pills and things like that up to us in New York. And this is, the fall of 66. And so we'd get these cartons of all kinds of different pills, orange ones and green ones and so forth. And some of them were what they called diet pills. What they really were is amphetamines. And so I popped them, and I felt great, went in the studio. And, before I knew it, I was hooked on them. I took a lot of them during the 1960s, and then I quit after that. But it was a real, they will make you psychotic. And so behind all this other stuff was going on was this addiction to amphetamines. And so I was doing the 60s.
And you said you'd stay up for days on end.
Mm-hmm. I would.
How many?
We'd be writing, and I just wouldn't want to quit. I would just pretty soon it would be the next morning, and there I was. In 1986, I finally went to the Betty Ford Center, and because I'm an alcoholic too, it didn't matter. And I finally rid myself of a life of addiction in 1986, and I've been sober for 31 years now. So
good for you.
Thank you.
You survived a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
That's why we put that in the intro.
No, that's true. You're quite right.
Yeah. Indomitable is what you are.
I'm still here, thank God.
A lot of
God.
Stuff happened.
The good Lord was looking out for me. I mean that sincerely.
Let's talk about one of the fascinating parts of the book is when music changed. When you guys were, you'd said you'd kind of inadvertently invented bubblegum, which is one of my favorite things in the book. But
me too.
Yeah. And then you're off working for Hubert Humphrey,
you guys were campaigning for the for Humphrey, and everything changed. Music changed.
Yes, right under our feet.
Yeah.
Well, it was interesting because a lot of things actually were leading up to this. The Sgt. Pepper album did so well the previous – this is late 67 now. When the record companies saw the money that could be made from albums rather than singles, that's really what changed. Only it took several months for that to really come about. And in 1968, Hubert Humphrey's office had called us, and we went out on the road, and with Hubert Humphrey, we became his opening act, basically.
And, well, before that, you were working with Bobby Kennedy.
Well, we had done a rally,
yeah,
just one rally with Robert Kennedy and Gene McCarthy, and the mayor of New York was running for president, and John Lindsay.
Mayor Lindsay,
time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was in New York, and we had been asked if we would play. I can't think of the name of the park, but it's down in South Manhattan. And
Union Square?
In that area.
Yeah, okay.
And a big park and an outdoor stage and a lot of college kids, you know, a lot of kids came up and were yelling, "Sell out! Sell out!" at us, you know. And but we played and all the candidates spoke, and we got put on a list. And so, as a matter of fact, we were asked to play at the Robert Kennedy, you know, at the Ambassador Hotel, where he was assassinated in later that year. And, of course, we couldn't go because we were playing a gig in, of all places, Dallas, Texas. And
that's a weird part of the book.
Oh,
you're
very
in Dealey
strange.
Plaza.
Yeah.
And we, then you
I
got
went,
back. And
that's right. After this was actually the day before the primary in L.A., or the primary in California. And so we had done a gig called the World Teen Fair that night. And the next morning, I'm headed back to New York, and I had to stop at Dealey Plaza. And went there. I was amazed, by the way, how tiny an area this was. Really tiny.
Have you been there, Gil?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You think of it as being large, you know, this humongous area, but it's really very small.
Because it's such a moment of history.
It is.
You
and
picture it.
It's the only thing I can compare it to is going to Pearl Harbor and being where the Arizona went down. And there's this solemnness, this quiet, this incredible quiet that the silence is deafening. I mean, it's really amazing. So anyway, I then left feeling really weird. I had a bad case of the weirds after I went there and saw everything for myself. And I go home back to New York. I turn on my television as I got in and started to unpack just in time to hear that there'd been a shooting at Kennedy headquarters in Los Angeles. And I couldn't believe it. And so, you know, stayed up all night watching. And finally, he was pronounced dead the next day. And I just went into a funk. I can't explain it, really. I just I felt like the world was ending at that point. And, you know, I was 21 years old and had seen a lot of this stuff. I couldn't believe it. And a couple of weeks later, we get a call from Hubert Humphrey's office, who was vice president running for president at the time. But they knew he was going to be the nominee. And they asked if after the convention, we would meet him in Wheeling, West Virginia and play for the rally. And okay, sure, okay, we will. Absolutely, I'd be honored. So we're watching the night of the convention, we're watching up at my apartment, watching TV, and all the kids are getting beat up. And you know, we go, what in the hell have we got ourselves into? You know, is every rally going to be like this? Is there going to be this kind of violence everywhere we go? And so anyway, he finally got on at 2 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And we indeed met him the following Wednesday or Thursday in Wheeling, West Virginia. And he couldn't have been nicer to us. He was.
He winds up writing liner notes.
He did. We did the whole campaign. He asked me to be president's advisor on youth affairs. Wow. I think I said something like, "Believe me, the youth are having affairs, and I'm just the guy to lead." But we became friends, as friendly as you can be with a 21-year-old and a guy running for president. He was just so good to us, and they gave us a jet from Butler Aviation out of LaGuardia, and anytime we could make it, we'd hook up with him. And we were there right until he lost at the Leamington Hotel that night.
And you said, I think it was with the BBC.
Yeah.
You told them you were...
Yes, I told them that I felt it was... I was supposed to... Moni was the number one record of the decade in England. It was bigger over there than it was here, believe it or not. And we were asked to do a tour over there in the Top of the Pops show, which was a big BBC show. And I had to cancel because I was doing the Humphrey campaign. I just felt it was more important. Uh-huh. I said, please understand, they said we will never play another one of your records, which they didn't do. I got into a big fracas with the BBC over that. I didn't mean to. But at any rate, that's how. What was your question?
I mean, that's just how they responded.
Yeah. And they.
That whole thing was a turning point, too, because you talk about in the book how you came back.
Yes.
And
music changed. I'm sorry. I got into
that's
this whole
okay.
thing. You asked me about music.
That's okay. No, the Humphrey stuff's interesting.
You should ask me, how you doing, Tom?
The Humphrey stuff's interesting, too.
And before I forget, Mayor John Lindsay gave Florence Henderson crabs.
Yes. Yes, that's what she claimed.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, that blows my story.
Yes. John, what were you doing when he was doing all this stuff with Humphrey right around that time? Were you still in the military?
I was mad.
Yeah, he was trying to heal from Moni.
I was putting a gas mask on.
Oh, you were still pissed off.
That's right, poor John. Well, I just wanted to say, Hubert Humphrey then ended up doing the liner notes to Crimson and Clover.
Righto.
The liner notes to the album. And, you know, we did commercials, and he did commercials for us and everything. But when we left on the campaign in August, the biggest groups on the radio were, you know, the Rascals, the Association.
Right.
Probably Gary Puckett. You know, all singles acts, right? When we got back 90 days later, it was all albums.
It was Led Zeppelin.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Led Zeppelin, Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Oh, I missed those singles days.
Yeah, well, you know, and then suddenly everything changed. And we realized that if we didn't start selling albums, our career was probably over. And Roulette, of course, was a singles label. They never really sold albums. So at that moment, thank God, we had a little record called Crimson and Clover. And Crimson and Clover allowed us, I can't think of any single we ever did that like Crimson and Clover that would have allowed us to make that jump from AM top 40 singles to FM album-oriented progressive rock. And I can't think of any other record that would have ever allowed
us to do
that.
Was that a happy accident, or were you consciously trying to make the transition into more psychedelic?
Both, but we were very lucky because Crimson and Clover really, and then we almost blew the release of Crimson and Clover. I mean, I tried to ruin my career.
Oh.
I tried. I tried so many
Gilbert,
ways.
You could relate.
Yes. You could have been my advisor.
Perhaps you heard about his infamous tweet.
No.
Yes.
What'd you do?
Did you guys prepare Crimson? Well, what did you plan to play? Because
another thing, you had dealings with the guy who was the real life Tony Soprano.
Well, yes. You know, the many of the characters on The Sopranos were characters from real life.
Oh, there was a Morris character.
Slight change. His name, they called Morris Moish.
Yeah.
Because his real name was Moisha. But Hesh. On The Sopranos.
That's right.
Was you know, the Jewish record producer who had the horse farm in upstate New York.
Recognized it immediately.
Yeah. And, and of course, Tony Soprano was Tony Salerno, you know.
Fat Tony.
Yeah, Fat
yeah.
Tony.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, you know. And I've become very good friends with little Steven, Stevie Van Zandt. And he's introduced me to so many of the guys on the show. And it was one of my favorite shows. It was The Sopranos.
Well, unlike them, you lived it. Yeah. They were actors cast to play parts.
Did you ever watch The Sopranos and go, no, that didn't happen?
Well, you know, I obviously saw some of the characters were people that were taken from real life. You know, some of them that I had rubbed shoulders with. But
what else did you guys prepare to play? And I'll keep Gilbert out of this one for the good of music.
A medley of my cowboy hits, wasn't it? No. Look over yonder. What do you see? The sun is rising. Most definitely. And a new day is coming. People are changing. Ain't it beautiful? Crystal blue persuasion. And you better get ready. Gonna see the light. Love, love is the answer. Maybe that's alright. So don't you give up now. It's so easy to find. Just look to your soul. In your mind, crystal blue persuasion. Mm-hmm. It's a new vibration. Crystal blue persuasion. Crystal blue persuasion. Better get ready. Down on every green field in every town. Gonna see all of his children in every nation. There'll be peace and good, brotherhood. Crystal blue persuasion.
Wow. That sounded great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It was missing me, but still. Considering.
I told you, you get a tambourine, you got a gig.
How did that song come together, Tom?
Well,
because it was a big departure.
Yeah, it was one of those songs that just kind of happened by accident. There was we were playing at college in Atlanta, and a kid came up to me with a poem called "Crystal Persuasion," and I went, "Whoa!" And we were always on the make for neat titles or neat hooks, something. And I looked at it, I thought that was such a great combination of words. Had nothing to do with the song, the end of the song. So we went back to the room, and Mike and Eddie and I wrote the song in about 20 minutes. And Eddie came up with just a little line like that. And it was really taken lyrically from Book of Revelation in the Bible. And then we went in the studio and produced it, and we just totally overproduced it. It was, I never have ruined a record like I ruined Crystal Blue Persuasion. And I went in, and we had guitars, and we had a full set of drums. And we I just remember looking at the engineer. I says, this is not the song. And so we spent the next 2 weeks unproducing it, pulling everything out. And when it ended up finished, it was nothing but a conga drum, a flamenco guitar, a little rhythm guitar with the tremolo on it, and an organ, no drums, nothing. And so we had to empty it out and let it breathe to be Crystal Blue.
And
great. It's one of my favorites.
Thank you.
You, early on, when you were desperate for to make a record,
yeah,
you met some guy, and he had he was going to produce a record for you, and you he had all the best recording equipment and everything, and then he said to you, but first you have to record my song.
Yes, yes. One catch to this. No, you're talking about the guy who recorded Hanky Panky, Jack Douglas, who was the morning man on WNIL radio. And he, this is back when
Didn't
I was—
Didn't he go on to work with John Yoko?
Oh, Jack not Douglas? The same Jack Douglas.
Oh, okay. Different Jack Douglas.
And so this is way back in Niles when I was about 15. He brought us into the—16. He brought us into the studio and he said we were going to do Hanky Panky, you know, right away. And he says, oh, by the way, guys, you got to record. I want you, before we do your song, we got to do my song. Oh, so we did his song, and it was some god-awful thing. It was called Pretty Little Red Bird.
Do you remember any of it?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Wait. Pretty Little Red Bird. An Indian maid with a feather in her hair and a big black braid. Red bird, red bird, pretty little red bird. I'm in love with pretty. Oh, God.
Fantastic.
So, anyway, that was.
Paul Revere and the Raiders kind of a thing, too.
That wasn't a hit.
No, and I couldn't understand it either. It had everything. Musk. Anyway, so that died quickly, thank God. And we got to do our song then after that. That was Hanky Panky.
Yeah, and the rest is history. And speaking of producing, tell us about you're in the studio.
I am. We're doing a brand new album called Alive.
John with you in there?
John is with me.
Great.
Very definitely.
Great.
And we are planning to come out with the album the first of the year.
Wonderful.
And it's my first studio album in 10 years, and we've got a lot of interesting people. Stevie Van Zandt's on. We did a remake of Dragging the Line, by the way, which Stevie Van Zandt is on, and he killed it. He really killed it.
Can't
He's
wait
great.
To hear that.
He's great. And, it's just there's a bunch of people on it that are with me. But I must tell you, this is a real labor of love, and a lot of songs that I was going to record years ago and just never did, and we did them on this album.
The album is called Alive.
Alive.
Yeah.
Which I think is a pretty, it's one of those titles that you remember.
Yeah.
Now, you also were around with the payola scam.
Oh, yes. Sure. And well, I went, the original payola with Alan Freed.
Yeah.
I wasn't around for that. But do you know that Morris Levy was his manager?
Of course.
I'm not kidding. Yeah. I'm not kidding. Yeah. But he was Alan Freed's manager.
Right.
And together they came this close to trademarking the term rock and roll. Can you imagine?
Yes. Wow.
Yes.
Can you imagine what that
now, now, and isn't it too that they save their own asses by having Alan Freed
take the fall?
Yeah.
Well, that's probably true. Alan died penniless, unfortunately. I never got a chance to meet Alan. He had already passed away by the time I made it. But, his presence was very much felt up there. Not only was Morris his manager, but all the history
Because he was like one of the biggest radio
came from guys. Cleveland, and yeah. and he was on WINS for years. You
and
know?
It speaks to Morris's vision a little bit too, because didn't he bring Alan in from Cleveland
he
to
did.
New York?
And- he did, and had the wherewithal to realize that rock and roll was here to stay.
Yeah, well, and he also managed Birdland. I mean,
he invented Birdland.
Birdland.
Yeah. Morris is it was his nightclub.
Yeah. And K-Tel Records was also
well,
part of his
Morris's
legacy.
Morris's story is fascinating
yeah.
because
he's kind of a genius.
he really is, and yeah. and it really was the what happened at Birdland was all these great artists. Stan Getz wrote "Lullaby of Birdland." It was mm-hmm. like his it was Morris's first copyright. Morris got into the publishing business first, and. I'll never forget the story of, you know, he had a jukebox in Birdland, and the ASCAP guy came around and asked for money, and, you know, said money, you know, you owe for the, and Morris thought the guy was trying to shake him down. And so he asked his lawyer, he said, what's up with this guy? He says, no, you got to pay me.
He says, boy, am I in the wrong business.
So he has... He has all of these artists write songs and record, and his jazz catalog was unbelievable. He started a record company.
And Latin music, too.
Yeah.
Had a thing,
and know, then George Goldner came along, and he and George Goldner started making records. And, you know, he had End Records, Gone Records. George Goldner did Little Anthony, he did the Flamingos, the Chantels. And, of course, Morris ended up with all this stuff. Because George was a gambler and would lose tons of money at the racetrack. Morris would buy his masters and buy his publishing, and Morris ended up with this incredible master catalog and publishing catalog of rock and roll and jazz.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was just before he was 30 years old. I mean, it was just an amazing story. And... Morris is really the star of the book.
He really is.
You know.
Well, it's the relationship. It is this weird, conflicted father-son dynamic.
Yeah.
And it is one of these things, like, as all the money he cheated you out of, and yet had you gone with another label, you would have had Hanky Panky.
And that would have been it.
And you'd be singing at a... county fair.
On a boat somewhere.
Which leads me to a question from one of our guests, and we'll wrap this up soon. But this is a little thing we call Grill the Guests, where our listeners get to ask the guest questions. And this is from Laura Pinto, and she says, hi, Tommy. Having read your book, which was fascinating, I'm left with the impression that despite all that happened with Morris, there was still a genuine love for the man. Is that so, and do you think it was mutual?
Well, it is so. And, I mean... whether it's mutual, I don't know. It's hard to say. That was sort of would have been wrapped up in my last conversation with him that I never got a chance to have. And but whenever I think of Morris, I listen. I'm as tied to Morris Levy and Roulette as you can get, because my entire adult life, everything I do and everything I am. Was brought to the surface because of being with Roulette Records. So, you know, I'm blessed.
Yeah.
When I get to heaven, I got to ask God about a few of these things. What'd you have in mind? What were you thinking?
I heard you say you're still haunted by him in some ways.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can bet that if this book and story had if he'd been alive, he'd want to own it. He'd demand own it.
John, did you have the pleasure of meeting Morris at any point?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
How you doing?
What was your experience of the man?
I don't think I was in his office for more than 5 minutes at a time. Uh-huh. I was just like, you know, in and out with Pete.
Intimidating, though.
Yeah. It was quite a character. Big guy.
Yeah.
In charge.
He was. He was very intimidating.
All the time.
I hope when the movie's made, you have a role in the casting of the film. Because
John's going to play a corpse.
but I'm gonna speak, though, so this way I'll get paid.
The lines are easy, and there's not a lot to memorize.
We should say there's kind of a happy ending, because when your music finally goes to CD, Tommy, you did get your royalties.
Well, you know what was amazing is when Morris in 1987 was convicted of racketeering and all the rest, and he was sentenced to 10 years in prison. And the first thing he did was unload the publishing and then the masters. The publishing went to EMI, which ended up with Sony, and the masters ended up with EMI, which ended up selling to Warner Brothers, Rhino. So, you know, my music is in the hands of reputable people now. And we have this, it was like
Moses going to Pharaoh, let my music go.
And when it finally happened, it was very strange because we made back a great portion of what we had lost.
Right. Of course. Can I ask you a question? We had Peter Asher here. We had Rupert Holmes here. Ron Dante, other guys you know.
Ron Dante's a good friend.
He's amazing. What a wonderful guy.
But what a history he's had.
Yeah, we had Mark Hudson here too, who I know.
Sure.
And we asked Ron and we asked Peter this question, and I think we asked Rupert too, had a big hit with Pina Colada, and we want to ask you, what is it, because you alluded to it before, what is it like, very few people on the planet can answer this question, what is it like to have that hit record for the first time, to experience that?
Well, it's like falling in love for the first time. It never can feel that good again. Honestly, when Hanky Panky hit, it was such a monster record, and it felt so good. The funny part is you memorize everybody else's record when you listen for your record on the radio.
Well, you were working in a record store, so you were plugged into that world.
That's true. That's true. And then as you have, we were so lucky to have more and more and more hits. We ended up doing about 110 million records with Roulette. We did 23 gold singles, 32 chart records, just an immense number of records sold. And we were so lucky. I mean, there's so much, of course, we didn't go into about music and records and what happened here, what happened there. All I can say is that I've been really blessed to be able to do what I love doing the most. All my life, and I can't believe here we are 51 years later and we're still doing this. I am just so lucky and so honored and so blessed. I mean that sincerely.
That's
great
to hear.
Good Lord and the fans for the kind of longevity.
That's great.
We've had.
And you one time got an accountant.
Yes.
To approach Mars Levy about your $40 million.
Yeah.
And what did Mars Levy say to your accountant?
You use that and they'll fish you out of a river.
Incredible.
That was to my accountant. He said, Tom, I don't think this is going to work. Yeah, I think you better find it.
The scariest part in the book is where you take it on the lam to Nashville
because
Morris disappears one day. And
well, let me just tell you, there was, I don't want to get too deep into this, but what it boiled down to is in 1971, there was a big gang war going on in New York City. And the Gambinos were taking over. The other families, and Morris was on the wrong side. So, there were so many people who ended. Every time you picked up a newspaper, there was another casualty. A body was found here or there. And so I was told in no uncertain terms it'd be a good idea if I left town. Morris suddenly left town, went to Spain with Nate McCalla, who was his enforcer. We were all left holding the bag at Roulette. So I was told by my lawyer, be a good idea if I left town for a few weeks till this blows over. So I ended up going to Nashville, and Pete Drake and I and DJ Fontana, Elvis's drummer,
sure.
and Scotty Moore, who was Elvis's guitar player, made an album down there called My Head, My Bed, My Red Guitar. It sold 4 records, and but Rolling Stone said it was the best album I'd ever done, so I'll take the Stones thing. At any rate, I came back, several months later, but I had to, as they say, go on the lam.
You went to the mattresses.
Yeah. Here I am, this hit kid from the Midwest.
I know.
I still got a hayseed sticking out of my tooth.
It's a great story. It's you know, you're reading it. Gilbert and I were talking before you got here. You're turning the pages of that book, and you're saying this is a movie. You know.
Yes. Well, it felt like it.
Hopefully with the music in the movie,
yep.
too.
You know? Well, there's some room for a couple of songs in there. Yeah. By the way, I'm going to be co-producing this film with Barbara DeFina, and also going to be doing a lot of the music. So it's going to be a real interesting—
It has to happen.
Yeah. I hope so. Yeah. Your mouth to God's ears.
And tell us about the tour, too. Where are you guys? Because—
We are all over. If you want to come to our website, just TommyJames.com, mm-hmm. and see where we're playing, where we're performing. We're on Facebook, Twitter. We're doing the social media.
Didn't you just play with the Grassroots, some of these guys, Cow Sills? You just did a show.
Well,
right?
I had a 50-year at the Garden State Arts Center.
Kate Taylor.
Yes.
Yeah.
The PNC Arts Center in New Jersey. We just did a 50-year celebration of my career, and we had so many of the people that I was involved with and that I knew. And yeah, the Cow Sills were there, Alive and Kicking, who I produced.
Oh yeah, Tighter, Tighter. You know that song, Gil?
Oh, how does that?
You know it, Tommy. Wait. Tommy produced that record.
Hold on, just a little bit tighter now.
Oh,
yeah, I love that one.
I love you so much, and I can't let go. A little bit tighter now, baby. Well, you know that.
Always love that one.
Thank you.
Alive and Kicking.
And before you go, even if it's just one stanza of the song, I gotta sing Moni Moni.
Oh, okay, okay.
He'll indulge
you. But I need the words. Do it.
Well, they'll carry it.
Yeah.
Well, here she come now, say Moni Moni. Well, shoot 'em down, turn around, come on, Moni. Hey, you give me love and I feel alright, yeah. You got me tossing and turning every night, but I feel alright. I said, yeah,
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 yeah.
That's as much as I do without getting paid.
You got room for Gilbert on the
Union top. Scale is next.
You don't know how you made his month with that one. I was enjoying that a lot,
yes,
Gil.
Yes.
Right until you came in.
Yes.
You're a sport, Tom.
That's what
and
most,
John.
That's what most women have said to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I told you. He sat here.
You're a sport. Yeah.
No. I enjoyed you until you came in.
Oh.
Yeah.
We will send you a clip of Gilbert singing MacArthur Park with Jimmy Webb right in
MacArthur
that chair.
MacArthur Park.
Yes.
Yes. And
MacArthur Park is fogging in the rain.
You got it.
Oh.
He did Wichita Lineman, too. We're gonna cut an LP.
That's a hard
Ooh.
One.
You know, you're right. You could take these songs and have him sing his version. I like that.
You like that?
That
idea.
Would sell.
I
baby.
Got him doing Sugar Sugar, Wichita Lineman, Rainbow Connection.
Yes.
Tie a Yellow Ribbon.
Nice to Be Around.
You did say he said.
You know,
Paul
you got a market for that. You could sell that to mental patients.
Yes. That's right. When the cops want to disperse rioters, it would also
right.
yeah, it would also come in
right.
handy. So the album is called Alive.
Yes, you remembered, see?
Yes. The tour, go to Tommy's website, TommyJames.com.
Right, we're going
And the book is Me, the Mob, and the Music.
Yes, sir.
One hell of a ride with Tommy James and the Shondells.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful.
Oh.
I had a ball. I got to tell you, I haven't had this much fun since... The Schwartz Bar Mitzvah, wasn't it?
You're too kind. We had a ball. Thanks, John. Thanks for doing this.
And it's Jonathan Ash.
Oh, and send people to John Ash's website, too.
Yeah.
John, what is that?
JonathanAsh.com, but leave the last A off for savings.
By the way, did I hear you make a Broadway Danny Rose reference in an interview that I saw online?
Yeah.
You said to the interviewer, "May I interject something at this juncture?" And I said, "I recognize that."
You're right. You got that, right?
You gave yourself away. Thanks, guys. This was
a treat
for us.
It's great.
Well, so wonderful.
Thanks, guys.
This has been Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host, Frank Santopadre. And we have been talking about how former New York mayor John Lindsay gave Florence Henderson crabs.
Is that what we were talking about?
Yeah, and then we had some musician in.
Yeah.
We want to thank Carol, too. Setting this up. Thank you so much, Carol, for your work.
Thank you for letting me sing two duets.
You were good.
Yes, with the great Tommy James.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, Tommy.
Thank you, guys, very much.
A treat for us.
Thank you.
Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast is produced by Dara Gottfried and Frank Santopadre, with audio production by Frank Verderosa. Our researchers are Paul Rayburn and Andrea Simmons. Web and social media is handled by Mike McPadden, Greg Pear, Nancy Chinchar, and John Bradley Seals. Photography by Charles Eshelman. Special audio contributions by John Beach. Special thanks to John Murray, John Fotiatis, and Nutmeg Creative. Especially Sam Giovanco and Daniel Farrell for their assistance.